Friday Night Wine Fight contains coarse language and adult themes. Listener discretion is strongly advised.
Welcome to Friday Night Wine Fight.
I'm Bianca.
And I'm Amy. We are three Melbourne girls. Well, two of three Melbourne girls. Who had nothing better to do than start a podcast while we were all living the Vita lockdown. And now, well, we've been in and out of lockdown ever since.
Yeah.
Fun times. So we take aim at one topic each week with a bottle or three of wine, and we try to make some sense of it. Right, Bianca, tell us about this very special episode.
Well, tonight we have a very special guest, Mr. Jeffrey Deskovic. Jeff was wrongly convicted of rape and murder of his 15-year-old classmate, Angela Correa, in 1990. He was only 17 years old at the time of his conviction. Can you even imagine?
I can't even imagine what Jeff went through at such a young age. He served 16 years in prison before being able to have his conviction overturned in 2006. Jeff's story, from the time before he was convicted to the incredible work he has done after being released from prison, will amaze you. We were very fortunate enough to have the opportunity to have a chat to him about his incredible journey so far.
Yes, yeah, so we recorded this interview at 4 a.m. our time. So forgive us, loyal listeners, for not having our standard bevvies in hand as we dive into the remarkable story of Jeffrey Deskovic. Okay, let's welcome our first ever guest to Friday Night Wine Fight Hotline, Mr. Jeffrey Deskovic. Hello.
Hi, and congratulations on getting the pronunciation of my last name completely correct.
Oh, gosh, I try. I really do. Every time we do an episode and there's like some sort of European-esque last name, I'm like, gotta nail this.
All right, so we are diving straight into our questions. Right. Yes. Let's kick off. So, Jeff, it's Jeff or Jeffrey?
I prefer Jeff because it's more friendly and less formal, and I'm really friendly and open person. So,
So can you tell us about your life leading up to when Angela was murdered?
Yeah, so I lived in Peekskill, New York, which is the suburbs. It was I moved to Peekskill in 1978. So from 1978 up until time of my arrest in 1990, I had lived in Peekskill. It was a middle-class city. It was ethnically diverse. I lived in an apartment complex, and there were a lot of kids that lived in that complex and in the surrounding areas. I didn't really think of it this way then, but in hindsight, it's kind of clear that I was really living a double life in a way. So in school, I was, the kids were a little bit older than me, so I was quiet to myself. I didn't really fit in because they were a little bit older than me. I really wasn't into, drinking and parties and, chasing girls and organized sports. But after school, I was kind of the life of the party in that apartment complex and surrounding area. So kind of whatever I would suggest would be, what we did. If we're going to play stickball, if we're going to ride bikes, play basketball, play Monopoly, go video games, go watch a movie, kind of whatever I would suggest would usually be what we ended up doing.
Oh, that's awesome. That's Amy of our group.
That's me. I'm the youngest, and I was a year younger than my graduating class as well. So, yeah, I fully understand that. Okay, so walk us through what happened after poor Angela was discovered and the investigation undertaken by the police leading up to your arrest.
Sure. So one other thing, background-wise, I lived with my mother, grandmother, and younger brother. My father was never involved in my life in any aspect, and that'll play a role in what I'm about to share. Mm-hmm. So Angela was a classmate. Angela Correa was a classmate in two of my classes as a freshman, one as a sophomore. I knew her name. She knew mine. That was really the extent of it. We really were not even on a high buy basis. So she went missing. I remember there was a newspaper article that, you know, had her picture in it and reference, you know, it said teen missing. And there was an announcement made on the school PA system saying if anyone had any idea of where she was, that they should let the guidance student know. She was in a photography class. The professor assigned all the students there to take some pictures of foliage. And he had employed a buddy system, which involved pairing a male student with a female student. And the male student assigned to go with Angela to take pictures actually played hooky on the assignment. She had like a sheltered life. She really never went anywhere unless she was with her older sister or her parents. So she goes home from the school to her house with her sister. Her sister uses the restroom, and for some unexplainable reason, she left out of the house on her own with the camera, going to the wooded, going to the Hillcrest Park in Peekskill to take pictures. So maybe perhaps she wanted to, you know, stop the sheltered life bit a little bit, at least for that.
Yeah.
She had the misfortune. There was a path on a macadam path there that was led between an apartment complex there. There was a big wooded area, and there was a path on it, which really connected. It was like a back, unofficial backdoor way of going from the apartment complex to a school. And so while she was there taking pictures on this path, it's a very thick wooded area, and she came across a 29-year-old drug addict who was high, and she was by herself, and he attacked, murdered, and raped her. So her body she went missing, and her body wasn't found until like 2 or 3 days later. I remember that there was a newspaper article which even said teen found, and a picture of her, and it mentioned that, you know, she was found naked from the waist down. So murders were pretty rare in Peekskill. So this created an atmosphere of fear, rumor, paranoia. The city essentially shut down. I mean, parents were driving their kids to school and then coming back and picking them up and driving them straight home. There were multiple town hall meetings at which safety tips and updates/progress on investigation were made. So this really, you know, it was a lot of public pressure here on the police. And then in addition to that, at some point, the victim's family went to the state police and asked them to take over the investigation because they didn't feel like the Peekskill police really knew what they were doing. The state police did not take the investigation over, but they did let the Peekskill police, you know that the family went there and that they were watching. So another pressure ratcheting circumstance. That's the point of all of that. In the course of the police investigation, they interviewed a lot of students from the high school, and some of them told the police that they might want to speak to me because I was quiet and to myself and I didn't fit in, as we've covered earlier. So that put me on the police radar. In addition to that, I was a sensitive teenager, and this was really my first brush with death, and I had an emotional reaction to it. And so the police thought that my emotional reaction was suspicious in light of the fact that, you know, I really didn't even have a relationship with her of any kind. So they took that as some sort of sign that I was sorry for what I had done. And a follow-up thing is that they, not being very experienced in investigating homicides, the police department got a psychological profile from the New York Police Department, which is in the city. They deal with murders all the time. And so they were given a psychological profile of what the characteristics of the actual perpetrator were likely to be. And I had the misfortune of matching that profile. So a type of reinforcing factor. So for about 6 weeks, the police played this cat and mouse game with me, in which half the time they would talk to me as a suspect And the other half the time, they would pretend like they needed my help to solve the crime. You know, they would say things like, well, the kids won't talk freely around us, but they will around you. Stop in from time to time. They would ask me opinion questions and congratulate me that my opinions were correct. You know, they made me feel important. So prior to being a teenager, the career I wanted to have when I grew up was actually to be a cop. So that was how I was susceptible to that. And then in addition, they utilized the good cop, bad cop routine in which one officer pretended to be a friend. And I began to look up to that officer as a father figure. So eventually they got me to agree to take the polygraph test. They said they had some new information in the file and they wanted to share that with me. And that would allow me to be more helpful to them. But first I'd have to take and pass this polygraph. So the next day, instead of going to the school, I went to the police station where I thought the test was going to happen at. Because it was a school day, my mother and grandmother thought that I was in school, so they didn't call around looking for me. They drove me to the town of Brewster, which is in Putnam County. So it was about 40 minutes away. They took me across county lines, 40 minutes away by car, which meant I was not able to leave anymore on my own. I was totally dependent on the police. I didn't have an attorney present. They didn't give me anything to eat the entire time I was there. They gave me a brochure which explained how the polygraph worked, but I didn't understand it. But then I figured, what does it matter? I mean, I'm just I'm here to help the police, so let's just
get on. Yeah, you were helping.
Yeah.
So from there, they put me in a small room and gave me countless cups of coffee. By the way, this polygraphist that's doing this, he's actually a Putnam County Sheriff's investigator, but he does not identify himself as a police officer. So the whole time I thought he was a civilian.
Oh.
And it, from giving me countless cups of coffee to get me nervous, he then attaches me to the polygraph and then he launches into his third degree tactic. So he invades my personal space. He raises voices at me and he kept asking me the same questions over and over again. Mm-hmm. And he kept that up for 6.5 to 7 hours.
So with a polygraph, I just wanted to ask, with a polygraph, is all of that recorded, that interview?
It was not. None of it was recorded. There was no audio recording, no video recording. And as I'm about to mention, there was no signed confession. There was just the cop's word for it. And so that allowed them when they... So that allowed them when they came to court to leave the threats and false promise out of their testimony. So basically at the end of the 6.5 to 7 hours, he said, what do you mean you didn't do it? You just told me through the polygraph test result that you did. We just want you to verbally confirm it. And that really shot my fear to the roof. And then the cop who was pretending to be my friend, he says, look, the other officers are going to harm you. I can't hold them off any longer. You have to help yourself. Listen, just tell them what they want to hear. You can go home afterwards. You're not going to be arrested. Being young, naive, frightened, 16 years old, not thinking about the long term, just being concerned with my safety in the moment. I was in fear of my life. The fact that I didn't know where I was, that nobody else knew where I was either, loomed very large in my mind. And then there was, this push-pull dynamic, the threat and the... false promise I wasn't going to be arrested. So I made up a story based on the information they given me in the course of the interrogation. By the time it was all said and done, I had collapsed on the floor, into the floor in a fetal position, crying uncontrollably. And obviously I was arrested. I was charged with murder and rape.
Mate, it's just full on. I got chills. Yeah. Like, I know I've researched you, et cetera, and I've read about all what happened, and I listened to a couple of the podcasts that you've been on, but just hearing you say it now actually literally gave me chills. I just can't believe you went through that. Yeah.
At 16. Yeah. That's incredible.
Yeah.
I don't know how I'd handle that at 16. Like, I'm a fairly level-headed person, and I became a lawyer myself in later years, but at 16, I don't know how I would have coped with this.
I wasn't arrested. I was definitely taken away in cuffs. I wasn't fingerprinted or anything like that, and I was taken away and put in a room, and I won't go into why that happened, but Yeah, I was 17 and just a dumb teenager. But, yeah, I know how scary that was. Like, just the things they would say to me and the things, yeah, the way they did it, there was just one chair and one table. And so when the cop came, it came back into the room, I had to get up out of the chair, like, just yelling at me, get up, stand over there. I was like, okay.
Right.
It's really scary.
It really is. Mm. So before I went to trial, the results of the DNA test came in from the FBI lab, which showed that semen found in the victim didn't match me. But rather than acknowledge they made a mistake, you know, they continued to prosecute full speed ahead. The prosecutor got the medical examiner to commit fraud. See, he suddenly claimed when the DNA didn't match me that he remembered that he forgot to document medical evidence that he said showed that the victim had been promiscuous. And basically, to wrongfully convict me, they were willing to trash her reputation. And her family was not coming to court, so they had no idea of what was being said about her in the courtroom. Taking it a step further, he mentioned another youth by name that he claimed had had this encounter with the victim, but he never sought to prove that. He never called him as a witness. He never got a DNA sample from him. He simply made the unsupported argument to the jury.
All right. Well, so let's talk about the trial process. So, yeah, let's look at the trial process after you're arrested. I only know what I've sort of seen on true crime documentaries about the process in America. I know a little bit about what happens in Australia. I wasn't a criminal lawyer here in Australia. I worked in commercial litigation and property, but I do have a bit of a background. So walk us through what the trial process was like.
So my public defender essentially did not defend me. He never called my alibi the prosecution's case consisted of the officers testifying as to the confession while leaving out the threat and false promise. The DNA evidence came in, which excluded me. There was hairs on the body, which also didn't match me. That came in. And then my lawyer basically, you know, he never called my alibi. He rarely met with me. He never cross-examined. He never tried to discredit the medical examiner. He literally asked him no questions. He never explained to the jury the significance of the DNA not matching me. He never used that to argue that it proved the confession was coerced and false. He never should have represented me because of a conflict of interest, because the other youth that the prosecutor was falsely saying had slept with the victim was represented by another member of the public defender's office, and specifically by the lawyer who was supposed to be supervising him on my case. So that prevented us from calling him as a witness or us asking him for a DNA sample. In terms of the confession, it was not a signed confession, audio or video. And, you know, my lawyer would not allow me to testify. So when you're defending a case where there's a confession, you have to answer that confession. You have to explain it. You have to disprove it in as many ways as you can. You bring it together in your closing argument. But he didn't do that. You know, at times he argued to the jury the confession never happened. Another time he argued, oh, it happened, but it was coerced. At still a different time, he argued that it happened, but was false. So, you know, by arguing all these different theories at the same time, he had to have been standing there with no credibility at all. Mm. And beyond that, there were a couple of irregularities as to the trial. I don't know if you want to say anything about the defense lawyer that I just mentioned before I get into a couple of other irregularities about the trial.
No, you can just keep going.
It's kind of stunned, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're a defense lawyer now. Like, do you just look at this case and shake your head saying, yes, what were you doing? What were you doing?
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely. Yes, I was. Yes, I am. So, and other things that happened were, firstly, the polygraph results are not admissible in court because it's not reliable. It's not scientific. But, you know, the only way it would be allowed in would be if both sides agreed. But despite that, the judge came up with this backdoor rule, and he allowed the polygraphist to repeatedly tell the jury that I failed the polygraph, which, you know, then in addition to that, the victim's clothes were entered into evidence, including her bra, which was important because in one of the statements that they coerced out of me, I said that I ripped her bra off, and the jury asked to see the bra. And, you know, some bras cannot be ripped off of a body. That's just how they're built. So when they asked to see the bra, that's when the judge said, well, the evidence was left in the courtroom over the weekend, and apparently the janitors thought that it was garbage and it's been thrown out.
I just can't. I can't even. Like, that, just that little bit is just, why? It just makes me so mad. Oh, my God.
And the last thing I'll mention is that, now, I've learned later, many years later, that at the end, the jury deliberated for like 2.5 days. And at the end, it was 11-1 for a conviction. There was one holdout juror who did not think that I was guilty. And the jury sent a note out to the judge asking, well, if we can't come up with a verdict, then are we going to be kept sequestered over the Christmas holiday? Sequestered meaning kept in a hotel. Everyone understands what it is. All right. All right. So the judge said yes. And the jurors said that they were pressing him already. There was a lot of pressure on him already. And then when that note was sent out, that ratcheted up the pressure more. And they all wanted to get out of there. They did not want to be there over the Christmas holiday. And he wanted to get out of there also. And that was why he switched his vote.
You're talking about somebody's life here. Yeah. I mean, if it came down to it, and being a former lawyer now, I'm never likely to see a jury. Like, I'm not likely to be on a jury the way our system works. I'd be there for as long as it took, to be honest. It's a person's life. I can't understand that their whole thing was that they just wanted to get out for the holiday. That just, yeah, I can't. That's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And so the end result of it all was I was found guilty, and I'd been charged as an adult, so I was sentenced as an adult. I was given a 15 to life sentence, you know, despite the judge telling me on the record, maybe you are innocent. And I was then sent to a men's maximum security prison.
Yeah, wow. God. So can you tell us what it was like as a 17-year-old going into prison?
A kid.
It was terrifying. It was terrifying. I remember how large the prison wall loomed, how menacing the barbed wire appeared. I was 17 years old. I was maybe 150 pounds. You know, these were people like, you know, 25 and 30 year olds and older, you know, really fully formed, very muscular men. Many of them were guilty of serious violent crimes. And then I had this bullseye on my back, you know, I was there for a sex offense, not just a murder. And so, you know, there's a vigilante mentality where people are convicted of sex offenses. It was maybe 3 or 4 stabbings or cuttings in the prison every day. There was a lot of violence that did not involve weapons. There was gang activity. So there was this general environment of violence and adrenaline. They had a system of maintaining order in the prison called keep lock, which involved sanctions being implied on the prisoners if they were found guilty of breaking a prison rule, which would involve they would keep you in the cell 23 hours a day out of the 24. They'd send you less food. Sometimes the food would be 3 or 4 days old. You could take two showers 1 week. You could take 2 showers 1 week and 3 the next, rather than the shower daily as the rest of the population. You know, you could not go to the store and purchase any food items or anything while you're on that status, and you could not use the phone. So, you know, in the course of my incarceration, I was assaulted 6 or 7 times. And because I did my best to try to defend myself, and the prison considered that I was fighting, and so I had all those sanctions applied to me. It was very hard to adjust being into a prison cell, just being in with the prison walls. I had to keep fighting off feelings of hopelessness, helplessness, thoughts of giving up, suicidal ideation. The food was terrible. Sometimes the food was burned, and other times it was not fully cooked, and there was a lot of verbal abuse from the guards towards towards the prisoners. So maybe to sum it all up, I would describe it as a nonstop obstacle course featuring the guards, prisoners, and civilians all as obstacles to the main thing of the main goal, which is try to overturn the conviction and regain your freedom.
Wow. So how did your mother cope with the verdict? And you said you had a brother.
I did. Yes, my brother is 3.5 years younger than me. So the kids on the school bus used to tell him that his brother was a rapist, and they would say other nasty things, and they would try to.
Oh my God.
They would try to hit him and stab him with pencils, and eventually he dropped out of school and he turned to drugs and alcohol to deal with pain of my being away. I mean, he eventually cleaned himself up, but he still retains a lot of the mannerisms from when he was running the streets, and he still to this day has not returned back to school. So he never graduated high school.
That's a shame.
In terms of my mother, she used to tell me that the most difficult part of it was she knew that prison was very dangerous, and she was worried to have me there, and it was very hard when she would come and see me, and then it was time to go home, and she couldn't take me back home with her. So she said that was difficult.
Oh, yeah.
They put me in a prison that was 4.5 hours away from where I lived, so it was a really long trip. She used to come see me a couple of times a month, but in the last 5 or 6 years, like I guess the long trip really kind of grated on her, and I was lucky, I was lucky if I saw her once every 6 months. My brother came to see me 3 times in 16 years, not at all in the last decade. I had several sets of aunts and uncles that would come to see me and then disappear and come to see me and disappear, so... my grandmother used to come with my mother to visit me, but then she passed away 6 years into my wrongful imprisonment. So in a lot of ways, though not literally, in many ways, I did the time by myself.
Oh, wow. That's just, that's full on. Oh, you poor thing. I have a couple of prisony questions.
Sure, go ahead, ask.
So did you, like, in prison, did you get access to current music and movies? Like, was there like a recreation night? Reprise from all this bad and sadness that was going on? Like,
sure. So there was recreation. So some prisons had recreation every night. Elmira, where I spent majority of my time, they had recreation every other night from 7 to 10. The day that they did not have recreation at night, they had recreation for 1 hour in the afternoon. They did have movies where they in the big recreational area, they had 3 huge televisions. One of them was designated as the sports television, and another one was like for music videos, and another one was just for movies. So you were able to keep up with movies that way. Of course, that would be once they weren't in the theater, but on DVD or VH, VHO, however, VCO, whatever format there was used. But that way, and we did. So one bizarre thing is that they had this. They had like television in the cell. This was kind of bizarre to me. So what I mean by that is they had something in the back of the cell. They gave you headphones, and there was like 3 different holes in the wall in the back of the cell. And one of them you could stick it into was the television, but there was no picture. Well, the only thing you could do was just hear it. And that was ridiculous. So I didn't like listen to television very much. Now eventually in 1998, that was about 7 or 8 years in, they did allow us to purchase black and white television. So you could watch 4 or 5 channels, but that would also depend on what cell block you were in, because there were some cell blocks where the TV reception was so bad, you might get 2.5 stations out of the 5 stations. So there was that television. I did have a radio, And you know, I would listen to sports talk radio, but it wasn't really listening to sports talk radio. It was more like it was a lifeline to the outside. You develop little habits and things to try to make things more manageable. So like on Sundays during football season, I would listen to, I'd have the television on for the local football game, but then I would be listening on the radio to different games than that with the team I was more interested in. So I would listen to a 1 o'clock game, the 4 o'clock game, and the Sunday night game on Sundays. So Sundays were kind of like designated a football day. So I would do that. And when I would go to recreation, so I used to engage in this, and maybe all this is getting together. How did I survive? So belief in God was one thing. Another thing was that in my mind, I wasn't doing a 15 to life sentence. I thought I was just doing a year or two till the next appeal was decided, where I was sure I was going to win because I was innocent.
Absolutely,
and I used to go to the law library, and learning the law, and it had a feeling of empowerment. I used to collect articles about other people who were exonerated, and I would use that as inspiration and try to learn like who helped them and what route did they take. Another thing was when I would go to recreation, I would engage in this elaborate delusion where whenever I would play basketball or play chess or play ping pong, that I would pretend like I was a professional player and that so was everybody else. But it wasn't really like kids just having fun on a playground someplace. It was, I needed to leave the prison for a couple of hours. You know, I would listen to sports talk radio, but it was not listening to sports talk radio. This was more like a lifeline to the outside.
Mm-hmm.
I made use of my time. So I got GED and I completed an associate's degree in another year towards the bachelor's before the funding was cut for that. But I took advantage of other programs. I learned to type. I took computer repair, general business, plumbing, painting, food service. I took a class on how adults learned, and I worked as a teacher's aide for a year and a half. So I did that. And then I, from 1998 forward, I read like three or four nonfiction books a week. And the television, I mean, while it stayed off for the most part, I did, because I was writing letters looking for people to help me, and I was reading books. At the same time, there were certain weekly programs that I used to watch, and I would, again, engage in this elaborate delusion, and I would pretend like I was, when I would watch programs, I would pretend like I was visiting with friends.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Another question I had was, like, as far as the, like, my knowledge of the American prison system goes, like, drugs are an issue. Were you ever pressured into drugs or gangs while you were incarcerated?
No, I was not.
Okay.
I was aware that some people, I mean, the most prevalent drug that I saw or that I knew people were using really was marijuana, but
yeah. Okay.
I never partook of that though.
Okay.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've been through all of that. You found a way to cope, I suppose, through prison.
Yes.
Can you explain to us how you were released from prison and tell us about the people or the organizations that were pivotal in securing your release?
Definitely. So I appealed. So I appealed my case to the appellate division. That's the first court. The issues were that my right against self-incrimination were violated by the police, and I was innocent based on the DNA. There were like a total of 10 different, the issue of the evidence being thrown out, the issue of the polygraphist repeatedly telling the jury that I failed the polygraph. Those were all issues. In total, there were 10 legal issues. And the court ruled that I was not in police custody, that I was free to come and go as I wanted. So they ruled the statements were voluntary. They wrote that, which is ridiculous.
That's ridiculous.
No, if you think that's something, where do you get a load of this? Okay. They wrote that there was overwhelming evidence of my guilt, which is kind of a head scratcher considering that the DNA didn't match me. And then they get rid of the rest of my legal issues by writing that they had looked at the rest of my issues and found them either to be without merit or else not preserved for review. And they ruled against me 5-0 on that. And from there, it was all downhill. So the re-argument motion was denied in one word. Then New York Court of Appeals, the highest court in New York State, They declined to give me permission to appeal to them, so I lost there. I filed in federal court, but because the court clerk gave my lawyer the wrong information pertaining to the filing procedure, my paperwork arrived 4 days too late, and the district attorney, Janine Pirro, her office argued that the court should simply rule that I was late and dismiss my case, which is what happened. And then that ruling was upheld by the Federal Court of Appeals. So the two judges that heard that was a name probably that people have heard of in the world. Most people have heard of Justice Sonia Sotomayor, the so-called empathetic judge. And she upheld that, her and her colleague upheld that ruling twice. And then the U.S. Supreme Court declined to give me permission to appeal to them. So that marked the, that was seven appeals, and that was 11 years worth. And now I was permanently locked out of the court unless I could find some kind of new evidence. So at that stage, I turned to letter writing as my new legal work. So the idea was I was trying to find an investigator or an attorney that would be willing to take my case for free because I didn't have any money to hire one, and then hope that working together that they could find some previously unknown evidence of innocence, you know, so that I could get back in court and try to, you know, establish my innocence and go home. So I wrote four letters, I wrote four years worth of letters, and rarely got any responses. And eventually, then I went to the parole board, and because I maintained my innocence rather than expressing remorse and taking responsibility, I was denied parole. They referenced nature of the crime and my, So I thought I was going to die in prison there. In term at that point, so in terms of how I got exonerated, what happened after that was one of the letters that I wrote, which was in to a book author in care of a publishing company, was instead sent by the publishing company to this book to an investigator. And Claudia Whitman was her name, and she wrote me back right away. And she, when I showed her that the DNA didn't match me, she, you know, became, she never heard of a case before where the DNA excluded the defendant, and yet they had still been found guilty.
Well, so usually when, that's something that would, I mean, if you've got DNA on a body, that's usually the linchpin. That's the person that did it. When they find a match, that's it. So how they could say that your DNA was not on the body and then specifically say, oh, but you still did it. That just blows my mind.
Right. So when she saw that like that, then she, you know, she believed in me, and she tried to get people to take my case. And then she, one of her ideas was the winning one. She suggested I write the Innocence Project again, which was a organization in Manhattan in New York that frees wrongfully convicted prisoners across the country where DNA evidence can demonstrate innocence. So they would get the DNA and test it and then introduce it back into the court as newly discovered evidence. You know, and exonerations would follow. So the problem is that when I originally wrote to them, the DNA was already known to the jury, and so that wouldn't have been something new. So what changed was the DNA data bank was created in 1997-98. And so Claudia told me that the with that new technology, the prior denial was irrelevant, so just write them again. So I did. And I wouldn't have thought to write them again on my own. And then she also lobbied them to take my case. And she got other respected legal entities to lobby them also. And then she also, so that was her. But then Maggie Taylor was an intake worker inside the Innocence Project. And when the lawyers did not want to take my case again because the DNA already excluded me, she presented my case to them three times. Before getting them to agree to take it. So getting the representation was the key. Second thing was Janine Pirro left office, and her successor allowed me to have the further testing. Because along the way, Pirro had blocked me from getting DNA testing several times. And the third thing is we got lucky that the actual perpetrator's DNA was in the DNA data bank, because which allowed when we put the evidence in there, that's how we got a match. So his DNA was only there because left free while I was doing time for his crime, he killed his second victim 3.5 years after killing the victim in my case. So on September 22nd, 2006, all the charges against me were dismissed on, my conviction was overturned and I was released. And I went back to court November 2nd, 2006, at which point all the charges against me were dismissed on actual innocence grounds.
Wow.
It's incredible.
it's just floored by this. This is amazing.
And he was arrested. So he was arrested and, you know, well, confronted with the DNA evidence, he admitted he was a person who committed the crime, and he was arrested and convicted of the crime, whereas there was a study put out by the Westchester District Attorney's Office, which explained, you know, all the different ways in which the system broke down, which culminated into my wrongful conviction and the preservation of that for the 16 years.
Wow.
Yeah, just wow. All my questions now feel like I wanted to get to know, like, your life and everything like that. And everything you've said is just like blow me away. Like, my next question was, you know, did you learn to drive before you went into prison or after? And I feel like that's so silly now.
That's okay. No, but that's a good human interest. Let's move into some human interest stuff and even talk about reintegrating back into society.
Yeah, that's it. Like,
my questions too, actually, how you went with some of that stuff.
Sure. So I learned to drive before I went to prison, but I had not obtained a license. I hadn't taken the exam, so I only had gotten as far as the learner's permit. In terms of reintegrating, so it was very difficult reintegrating back into society, you know, after being away for 16 years, you know. So for one aspect of it, technology was different. Cell phones, GPS, internet had never been created. Neighborhoods didn't look the same. The same people did not live there. The culture was totally different. So taken cumulatively, it felt like I was in a parallel world that I didn't belong in. I had the psychological after effects of my experience. It's common for people to have PTSD, panic attacks, anxiety, feeling of having been frozen in time, feeling of processing things at a slower speed. So I used to see mental health experts. I used to go to mental health professionals four times a week for 6 years. There was the stigma of having been in prison for 16 years wrongfully. Yeah, but there for 16 years, how much of that rubbed off on you? You know, is it safe to be alone someplace with you? So there was that to deal with. Then, in addition to that, I was particularly hard because I didn't have a license before. I had never lived on my own. I never had to go shopping. I never had to write a check or balance a budget either.
All these normal things that we just do day to day, like without even thinking about it. Oh, wow.
I was always passed over for gainful employment. So, you know, it was hard. I did get a job as a weekly columnist, but it was a weekly paper, so they only wanted one article a week. And I was making money doing speaking engagements, but that's not a consistent form of income. So it was very difficult financially. At one point, I was a couple of weeks away from a homeless shelter. It was very lonely. Mercy College, which had given me a scholarship to finish the bachelor's degree, they allowed me to live on campus, which is how I avoided the homeless shelter.
That's good. Yeah.
Well, I mean, there was a rapid advancement in technology while you were in prison, like during the 90s and early 2000s. Mm-hmm. So things like mobile phones, the internet, stuff like that, you were in prison for, you know, basically the rollout of all of these things. So all of that was normal to the rest of us. But for you, this all would have been fairly new, I would imagine. So trying to cope with that, and also cope with all of the other things that you were going through as you spoke about, that must have been really rough. And how old were you at this stage?
It was very, very rough. I was 32 at that stage.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, Amy's in her 30s and she's just, she's the worst with technology. I handle it, like, throw it at me, I'm good. but
I am the worst with those sorts of things, and I live through it. I lived through the internet coming into schools and things like that. I've lived with mobile phone technology, and I still don't understand it. So I can't imagine coming out of prison and then having to adjust to not just coming out of prison and then all of the pressures that come with that, but also dealing with all of this extra stuff as well. Like, yeah, that is a lot for a person. So can you tell us a little bit more about, so what happened after you left prison? I know that you're now working as a lawyer and helping other people get the legal representation that they deserve. Can you tell us a little bit about how you became a lawyer and what made you want to become a lawyer?
Absolutely. And I want to add, related to the last question, that it was an awkward experience when I would meet up with members of my extended family, because I was a different person now and so were they. But at the same time, I knew who they were from memories of them when I was younger. So while all that difficulty was happening, I did get the scholarship from Mercy College to finish the bachelor's. I was able to get a master's degree. I became an individual advocate. So I was doing speaking engagements. I was writing. I was doing media interviews. I was regularly meeting with elected officials. And I thought that furthering my formal education would facilitate, the extra credentials would facilitate, you know, that vision in life of, you know, freeing wrongfully convicted people, doing policy work and broader criminal justice reform. So after about 5 years, I finally received some financial compensation, and I decided to, I took $1.5 million from that and started the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice, which would continue the policy work that I was doing as an individual, but would also be involved in freeing people who are wrongfully imprisoned. So the idea would be to reach back to people in the similar position that I was in. And so far, we've been able to help free 11 people. We helped pass 3 laws. We're part of a bigger coalition called It Could Happen to You, which I'm an advisory board member of. And we've been able to pass an additional 5 laws. At some point, I became not satisfied with sitting in the front row of the courtroom. I wanted to be able to sit at the defense table and make some of the arguments, represent some of the people. And so I decided to go to law school, and I became an attorney. And I am an attorney now, and I've entered some of those cases as co-counsel.
Oh, that's awesome. You covered all my next questions, too. So you freed 11 people.
Yes, to help free 11 people.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. That's just so heartwarming. I love that. So do you ever work in conjunction, like with the Innocence Project? Or
yes. Yeah. Yeah. Not yet. Not on cases, but on but on policy issues.
Yeah.
So on policy issues and in doing media. So I've appeared at any number of press conferences that they've arranged. And, you know, I've spoken at press conferences with them, and we push some of the same policy changes as well.
Yeah. So when you say that you've helped pass some new laws, is that right?
It is right.
Yeah. So what laws were they?
Sure. So videotaping interrogations. And so this would be in New York, videotaping interrogations and then identification reform, you know, better process for it. And then also DNA database expansion. Then as far as the coalition group, which I'm an advisory board member of and which the foundation's part of, we helped pass this, is called Commission on Prosecutor Conduct. So what that means is independent oversight for prosecutors. So we passed that. We passed a modification of that. We passed discovery reform, which pertains to, so now with the new law, you have to, information and evidence is shared automatically by both sides very early in the process, rather than evidence being turned over on the eve of a hearing or eve of a trial.
Oh, okay.
Then we repassed the Commission on Prosecutor Conduct. So the District Attorneys Association of New York, they didn't want any oversight. So they brought a lawsuit challenging the law. The judge rejected their arguments but found a problem in the appeal procedure. So we were able to repass a law. We'd recently repassed the law, just taking the judge's decision into account. Then in Pennsylvania, We had a success there that so there were so the law used to be the way that things were before is people were exonerated in court, but their record wouldn't be cleaned. And so that would hurt them when it came to going on job interviews.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was so we were able to pass that in terms of current objectives. So in New York, we're trying to pass parole reform, and there was a lot of deserving candidates were denied based only on nature of the crime, kind of like I was. And you know, there would be a parole review for elderly people. But then also when the law was passed, videotaping interrogations, it did come out a little bit watered down. So they made a bunch of exceptions for like second degree murder and sex offenses and drug cases. So we're trying to get rid of those exceptions. And in Pennsylvania, where our objective there is we want to pass the oversight for the prosecutors there. Mm-hmm. And then also Pennsylvania is one of 14 states that does not compensate exonerees at all. So we're working on that. Yeah. So imagine being proven innocent in court and then the state does not give you any money at all as compensation to try to help rebuild your life.
Yeah.
And then in California, again, we're trying to pass the oversight for prosecutors, but we are also we're also working on we're trying to get rid of the death penalty in California. So that's those are our objectives now, and we currently have 10 active cases.
Oh, I was super wondering, like, have you had any cases where, like, an incarcerated person or a person going through trials reached out saying, "Oh, I'm innocent," but they actually weren't innocent?
Yes. Yeah, sure. Ooh. That's happened.
Yeah.
We have a screening process in place. You know, we're not naive. We know that some people falsely claim to be innocent. Like I remember one case, for example, where so the defendant was living in a he was renting a room in a house, and the police did a search of the room where he was at, and they found illegal firearms, and we. So we asked him, well, you know, if his theory to us was he claimed that those were not his guns, that other people had access to that room in the house, and that somebody else must have put their guns in his room.
Sure.
And that didn't make any sense to us.
Yeah.
And then on top, because I mean, you know, why would you do that? Then when you come home, you're going to see them. You might call the cops. Who would do that? And then when we pressed him about that, his answer to that was, he said, well, it was an illegal search, so that evidence should not have been used against me in court, and so I don't want you to consider it within your deciding whether you're going to help me or not. We want you to exclude that from your consideration also. And, you know, so we laughed about it and closed the case, basically. Yeah, so that happened. Then another time, you know, somebody wrote us and they claimed they were innocent of an assault case, but they had gone, their defense at trial was that it was self-defense, that their defense at trial, they assaulted somebody in self-defense, but in their applying to us for help, they were claiming that they didn't do it and that they actually, that they had an alibi, that there was a new alibi witness that had been discovered and that would place him at a different place and different, you know, at that time of the crime. Mm-hmm. So those are a couple of examples. But yeah, there's cases like that we reject all the time. And there's a lot of people that write us that are not claiming to be innocent, but they're saying that their trial was flawed in one way or another, like the judge got an issue of law wrong, or that they were sentenced to too much time. They really should have gotten, you know, 10 years, but they got, you know, 20 or something like that. But, you know, those are beyond the scope of what, you know, I'm in moral support of that. I mean, if your trial wasn't fair, you should get another trial, no matter if you were guilty or innocent. If it wasn't fair, then let's do it all over again. You should be entitled to your right to fair trial, and you know, you should not be over sentenced, and if the facts call for a conviction on manslaughter, you should not be found guilty of murder and given even more time. But you know, but that's those things are beyond the scope of what we're able to do. I mean, as it is, we already have a really large backlog, and so a lot of the declined cases, the rejected cases are of that genre.
Yeah, in Australia, like if someone wrote in, you know, saying they're innocent, they really weren't, and you're reading it and you're just like, definitely not innocent. We would probably use the line from the movie The Castle. Tell him he's joking.
That's good. Yeah, that's really good. Now, I've been able to position criminal justice reform as, you know, both wrongful conviction and broader criminal justice reform. I've been able to position it as about justice and accuracy rather than like a cop or anti-prosecutor thing. Definitely against cops and prosecutors who are breaking the law and running over constitutional rights and not doing fair trials. But you know, as the people in those professions that do their job the right way, you know, I don't have any issues with them. And so I have been able to make some headway there. So I, for the last 7 years, for example, I've co-taught the ethics class to police cadets at a police academy. I've been able to speak in front of groups of certain prosecutor offices and other groups of prosecutors, and I've addressed groups of judges on a variety of different wrongful conviction topics that they've asked me to address. And, you know, I served on a transition team of a district attorney's office, and I wrote memos of how their conviction review unit should be set up and operate. And I did help submit proposals for improving, you know, policing. You know, did that with sitting police chief in Peekskill, and with a retired cop and then a county police officer on that subcommittee also. So I guess my point in mentioning those things is that I have been able to get some buy-in from law enforcement on that. So, yeah. You know, I try to pitch the tent, you know, as wide as you can, try to get as much support as you can while also staying true to your own principles. So, you know, yeah. I always make clear, look, it's not a few bad apples, okay? If that was the case, there would be 2,805 exonerations in the United States from 1989 forward. It wouldn't be all this brutality and unjustifiable deadly police force. So it's not a few bad apples. No, it's a hell of a lot more than that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, everybody in those professions isn't bad either. So I just kind of like walk in the middle on that while just trying to stay true to, you know, what's accurate.
I had actually a little tidbit. When I was telling my daughter that I was interviewing you for the Amy and I were going to interview you for the podcast. And she told me that she actually studied your case in her criminal justice studies class in high school. This is really? In 2018 when she was in, so we call it year 11, so it's the second last year of high school.
My case is being studied in Australia
in a little, like, we're down on the Mornington Peninsula. If you ever want to look it up, so we're on the Mornington Peninsula. Her high school that she went to probably only has I think about 700 or 800 students, but yeah, it's amazing. That's, I was like, great. How did you know about him? And she was telling me, he was wrongly convicted, and she couldn't really remember. I mean, it's 2018 and it's now 2021, but yeah.
Right. She remember. Wow, that's amazing. That's great. You know, I've done some speaking engagements in, you know, like in churches or the faith-based locations or community organizations and in some high schools, and there has been students that have come up to me and, you know, they've shown me a paper that they wrote about my case that they got an A on. Or one time there was a kid that was maybe like 12 years old and he had this big old piece of oak tag and he had my name on it and, you know, different key points of my case, you know, what he felt in his mind were highlights of the case, the exoneration. And, you know, and I've also gotten things like that from students in, you know, in universities or people in master's degree programs or PhD programs. So it does make me feel good that the case is studied and, you know, that is forming as an inspiration for people.
Yeah. So how important do you think it is, like, after what you went through at such a young age, to educate other young people about their rights when this, you know, if they're ever faced with this situation?
Extremely important. You know, everybody know, you know, most people don't know what to do if the police want to question you. You know, they think, well, if I haven't done anything, I don't know anything. I mean, nothing can really go wrong. You know, why would I need to, you know, ask for a lawyer? And that's just going to make me look guilty. But no, the innocence of a suspect often works against them, and it's really important to ask for a lawyer. And once they give you one, that'll level the playing field. It'll prevent them, police, from, it'll prevent the police from coercing you. And that's, you know, what happened to me. So I think that's extremely important. Just like, you know, you should never, ever agree to allow a police officer to search your car or search your home. You know, if they, and, you know, and you just be really clear about that. No, I do not consent to you searching. And if you search my auto, a car, or my house anyway, you know, you're not doing it with my consent. So you just verbally step out of the way, let them do it. But you're going to verbally tell them I'm not agreeing to the search, so that later on in court afterwards, you know, you have an issue that you can bring up in court. You know, but you don't go further than that. You don't get into some physical incident or try to physically resist. I mean, that could very easily turn tragic. But most people don't understand that. You know, they just let. And sometimes police have found drugs and guns where there was none, well, as a result of being allowed to search a car. So that's very important to know your rights and know what to do when that happens.
Oh, that was one of my questions was, like, I mean, as I said before, I was a lawyer, and I'm a bit of an advocate for telling young people that I'm close to that if they ever get into trouble with the police, that you can give the police your name and your address and then say you just want to call Amy and get them to call me, get them to contact me, and then say nothing else until you see me. I'll come to the police station and I will deal with it. But I have a great deal of respect for the police. I have family members and friends who are police officers, but yet I still tell kids, you don't say anything until I get there. I speak to them, you don't say anything. And that's even young adults, because they just don't understand their rights. What's your advice to children or to young people in general about when you get picked up?
100% the same thing you said. No alteration. Everything is completely the same.
Yeah. The thing is too that I find, because of my bad experience with the police, and I'm not all fuck the police or anything, absolutely not. I have utmost respect for them. Like, when my daughter had an item stolen of hers, we went to the police for help, and because I wanted to show her that not only the police aren't all bad. They can help us, and they did. Yeah. So you've got to, I suppose, have the flip side of it as well, that they are there to help.
Right. No, 100%. Yeah. No, I agree with that. And, you know, and I've asked, you know, and I've done interviews on, you know, other shows, and I've explained, the difference between, police that are good and that are doing their job versus other ones that are not, you know, not to be naive about them either. I do agree with that balanced approach. I personally do not support efforts of defunding the police. I mean, that's kind of the most ridiculous thing to me ever. If I call 911, if I call like emergency, I don't want to be put on hold, and I want a police officer showing up at the crime scene. I don't want a psychologist or, other mental health professionals showing up. That having been said, I do want the police to be better trained, and I do want accountability for when they do something wrong. They should be punished the same way that a civilian would be if he or she broke the law.
Yeah. Yeah, well, in Australia, I mean, we've watched what's happened over in America in the last 12 months, and things like defund the police, we can't grasp over here. We've had our problems, and obviously it's a rolling ball. We're trying to get better, but defund the police is just something that I just can't understand. But
I agree.
It's incredible.
Yeah. We have the same point of view there. You know, I have been able to do some advocacy work in other countries. Like, I did like a week long tour in Argentina, working with local advocates on the ground there. Fabian Camano, who has the only 3 books on wrongful conviction in Spanish. And so I participated in a lot of speaking engagements with him, and we met with various governmental officials, and I did a training session for the police in that country. And I did something similar in the country of Armenia, and I did speak before in Canada. So if anyone's listening, they're out there, I would love to come and do a tour in Australia.
Come to Australia.
Come and have a beer with us.
I would love to come and have a beer and tour some things, do some fun things in Australia, but also do some speaking engagements at the same time. You know, maybe government officials work with advocates there. And, you know, on a lighter side, I remember while I was in prison, one of the few lighter moments, like when I had the television, they had the beer commercials, Foster's. Which, you know, the Foster's, Australian for beer. And they have all these silly things on there, you know. And I remember, I remember that. That used to, you know, they're even on YouTube now. And that I remember I got a kick out of that. And, there was something not too long ago, right, that was kind of struck me as a little humorous, which kind of intersected with Australia. There was an incident where this kangaroo got his hands on a dog, and the owner of the dog and rushed up to the kangaroo and punched the kangaroo in the face, and then that thing went all around. And the end result of it, as I believe, the guy got fired as a result of that. I mean, you know, that just struck me as kind of comedic a little bit.
Yeah, we're built a bit differently over here. Like,
you
can go just swimming and just be like, oh, there's a shark. I'll just punch it in the face and swim off. Like, it's fine.
that took a lot of nerve on his part, though, to come up. I mean, the kangaroo could have kicked him, right? He could have jumped in the air and kicked him.
They are some scary beasts, I tell you.
And you can always tell tourists when you go to, like, Australian sanctuaries and things like that, is you can always tell the international tourists, because the Australians are not anywhere near the kangaroos.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden there's these people wandering through, and then all the Australians are on the fence just having a look. We've seen that. Move on. Yeah, no, we don't go in there. Nope.
Yeah, they think that there's kangaroos just hopping around all over the place. And do you remember? You remember the whole Crocodile Dundee series?
Yes.
Yeah, Mick.
Yeah.
Mick went on a walkabout, right? Yeah. And he threw some shrimp. And he liked to throw shrimp on the Barbie, right?
which is a hilarious saying, because we say prawns. So throwing a shrimp on the Barbie is just—it's not something that we say. Yeah. Anyway, circling back around. So you've had a very impressive career, and we just wanted to have a bit of a chat about some of the organisations. And I know that you're a bit of an award winner. I know you're a very humble sort of person.
Yes.
So I know you don't really go into it, but tell us a little bit about the organisations you work for and the awards that you've received.
Sure. So the organizations, so this is my foundation, Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice. I mentioned the coalition group, It Could Happen to You. So following our success in New York, we now are a national coalition, and we have chapters in New York, Pennsylvania, and California. So myself, the coalition's founder, and one more person, we're the only three people that are in common to all three of those chapters. I do serve on the Global Advisory Council for Restorative Justice International. I'm a board member for the National Justice Impacted Bar Association. So what that is they encourage formerly incarcerated people, whether guilty or not, to become lawyers and enter the legal field. I also co-own the Recharge Beyond the Bars Reentry Game, which facilitates formerly incarcerated people and with reintegrating back into society through icebreaker questions. So, like, I found
we're gonna talk about that game, because I'm very interested in that.
Yeah,
sure. But moving on to the I got you. So finishing out my answer. So I've done some volunteer work with this organization called RAP, which means release aging people in prison. And so my volunteer work for them, it has to do with the parole reform we've spoken about. In terms of awards, so I've won, I've won the Humanitarian of the Year Award. I've won the Public Sector Servant of Justice Award. I've won Advocate of the Year. I won Advocate of the Month. I've won the New Yorker of the Week Award. I've won the Agent of Change Award. I've won the, it's called the Sobri Pasternak Award, and that's an award given to the law student who has contributed the most to civil rights work while while a lawsuit, I've won a Conquest Award also, which is, you know, given to somebody that whose life has demonstrated that they simply don't give up. So those have been the awards I've gotten, and you know, I do feel very humbled by that, and I do feel very validated by that. And you know, the purpose of getting awards and even doing media is that, you know, as goes I, as goes my organization, to some extent, as goes the overall issue, I am simply a tool in the struggle. You know, my head is the right size. You know, my feet are firmly on the ground. So this is, you know, really not about me. You know, this is just, I want to increase the profile of the issue, the organization, and myself, just to be a more effective tool in the struggle. It's not self-aggrandizement or anything like that. And you know, my mission in the world, the way I make sense of everything that happened to me, is I do believe that, you know, I'm here to fight wrongful conviction, to free people that are happened what happened to me, and to do the preventative work and work on the broader criminal justice reform work. And that's how I make sense of everything that happened to me. You know, I'm not an angry or bitter person. I want to enjoy my life as much as I can. Mm-hmm. And I can't do that if I'm angry or bitter. I feel like I've lost so much as it is. Why would I want to in effect lose the rest of my life? And yeah. I would be the only loser in that scenario. And so I do have this, resignation, this acceptance, and that allows me to get to the place of just having the inner peace, you know, within me. And, you know, it's meaningful, it's healing, it's cathartic, it makes a difference. You know, my suffering counting for something, you know, is really, it's really big. Mm. It's really big for me. And the vehicle that allows me to actualize that is I take the energy that I feel and I channel it into the advocacy work that I do.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah. Well, we've only got a little bit of time left because I think you said that you were going to give us an hour and a half of your time. Mm-hmm. So definitely want to hear about this Recharge Beyond the Bars reentry game.
Right. So, so when I was released, I remember a conversation I had with my brother, and he said to me, I don't know what to say. I don't know what not to say. I don't know what to ask. I don't know what not to ask. So, and on my part of it, I found it very hard to communicate with people that I knew had never been incarcerated before, had never had any brush with the legal system or experienced reentry. So I had that communication challenge on my end of it. So Recharge steps in the middle and it removes the awkwardness through icebreaker type questions. So like one of the questions, for example, you know, is, you know, do you, you know, what's one, you know, what's one way that you change for the better while you were in prison, or what's one way that you're different now versus what you were? And so I play the game myself. I mean, I co-own it. I did not create it, but I did invest money into it, so I helped bring it to life. Mm-hmm. And so people can, so that's what it's about. You know, it is on the website, rechargethegame.com is the website. So that's my way of giving back. So I was helped by some prisoners who were rightfully convicted, and, you know, and so having a tool in place to help people like that in the reentry process. And I know a lot of people on parole, and I know that the overlap of concerns of difficulties of reintegrating are the same whether someone's exonerated or not. So that's my way of trying to give back something. Yeah. So that's what research is about.
That's so important, because recidivism is such a big problem. And unfortunately, it's one of those things that people who go to prison are faced with. They have all of these barriers, and then they get to a point where they just say, well, I guess this is me now. And they just continue to reoffend, because it just becomes a lifestyle when they could have gone to prison for something that was fairly petty. And then all of a sudden they've just built themselves into this persona, I suppose, because they feel like they have no other option. So I really feel that this game is important, and this sort of thing is important, and it's something that we need to have a conversation around in society about, you know, getting people right. back into regular society and reintegrating themselves. So I think this is really important. So how can people assist your nonprofit organization?
Sure. So I would like to have a chapter of the organization in each state and ultimately in each country, because I see wrongful conviction as a worldwide issue and not just a United States issue. And countries where we are not hearing about exonerations, wrongful mm-hmm. convictions, it's not because the wrongful convictions aren't happening. It's because nobody's working on them. There's no work being done. So hence the dream of wanting to have an office in each state and ultimately each country. So tying that back to how people can help. So there is a crowdfunding site called Patreon, which is for people who are willing to be recurring monthly donors. So imagine, for example, if 25,000 people were willing to sacrifice $3 to $5 a month in order to help us free wrongfully convicted people. So that would allow us to free more people. We could hire attorneys, paralegals, investigators, other essential personnel. Becoming donors, but also sharing word of mouth on social media, helping to get out of my network and into the network of many other people, helping it go as far and wide. That can certainly be a way of helping. Amazon has the Amazon Smile program, so you can register for the Jeffrey Deskwick Foundation as your charity, and Amazon will donate a small percentage of your purchase without it increasing the cost to consumers. So those are a few ways, and of course, if you know of other people that, whether it's a podcast, a blog, Block mm-hmm. Talk Radio, other forms of media, there's people that I can help spread the word out to do more interviews and raise their profile, that would be extremely helpful. I'm hoping at some point we can find celebrity spokespeople, people with the bigger social media following. So if you're out there and you're listening and you have a bigger profile, or you know somebody that does, love you to connect me with them. I mean, imagine a short video on wrongful conviction and the foundation, and I make a cameo appearance and it's put out there. And then with the Patreon, I mean, it could really help a lot. So these are all really manageable things. And I hope that some of the people listening will be inspired not only to help the cause and organization, but also think about entering the field themselves, whether that's as a lawyer, an investigator, or as an investigative journalist within the context of a nonprofit, fundraising, social media, public relations, grant writing. We see with the explosion of podcasts and documentaries and docuseries, there's a lot of on the reentry side of it, certainly room for social workers and psychologists. So lots of ways for people to get involved as a career. And if you're a lawyer out there and you're listening, whether you do criminal law or not, in your lifetime, you should aspire to do at least one wrongful conviction case pro bono in the course of your lifetime. So those are all some tools that people can use to get more involved. And sort of a prerequisite to that definitely would be learning more about wrongful conviction. And the Innocence Project website is a great resource for that. There's the National Registry of Exoneration as well. And I have a master's thesis out also. So learning more is a prerequisite to those things, and even just in general, because the more informed the citizenry we have, then the more clamor for change and support we can generate for changes to the justice system. So I do believe in learning from one jurisdiction to improve another. So in Australia, for example, I mean, the causes of wrongful conviction in the U.S. are known. Just like the remedies for it are known. So taking lessons from U.S. So if we know that coerced false confessions caused a lot of wrongful convictions in the U.S. and that the best practice there would be to videotape. So how do we do it in Australia? Do the police videotape? Do they not? But just as an example, looking at all the deficiencies and what the reforms are backed by social science, and just advocating for improving the justice system in whatever country person's in. So that's another way to be involved.
Yeah, well, we don't, well, I don't know anyone who's ever done a polygraph test, for instance. It's not something that is used. I think they do have it in Australia, and I think they have used it before. It's just not something that's widely used because it's not reliable and you can't use it in court. So effectively it's almost dismissed. Whereas in America, I know that they still use it even though it's not admissible in court. So things like that, I mean, they really need to look into these things, look at their tactics, look at their methods and say, okay, well, what produces the right result? The right result, not just a result, the right result.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So if I could end maybe with just something for the audience, from my life, everything, the challenges after wrongful imprisonment and during and going through law school and becoming a lawyer, there are some lessons that I extrapolate from that, which translate well beyond wrongful conviction, imprisonment, justice reform. So for overcoming adversity, I think have a goal. You should have a realistic plan. You could look at 3 or 4 different ways that you think that, yeah, okay, this could work. Be flexible. Remember that the goal is the goal. The plan is not the goal. So if an unexpected door or a way for you to advance towards the goal opens, but it wasn't part of the original plan, remember that the goal is what the goal is. So make the modification. Don't be afraid of hard work. I think you have to work really hard for everything you want to put yourself in position so that somebody could open the door for you or you could have a breakthrough. It's probably not going to just, pie in the sky drop into your lap. You have to put yourself in position for a miracle to occur. I think that there are no reasons why you can't do something, only reasons why something might be harder. Never give up. And I think that when you can't go on anymore, when I haven't been able to continue on at any of those sectors of my life we've talked about today, I say to myself, maybe this is the key moment right here. Maybe I was on the verge of a breakthrough, but because I quit, it's not going to happen. So even though I can't continue on anymore, I'm going to do it anyway, just to see what happens on the other side. Yeah. And then once you come through the other side, reach back and help somebody in the same position that you were in, do some work on the preventative side. And I know that those lessons can apply to, say, someone who's a domestic abuse survivor, someone who's a sexual assault victim, somebody who has been homeless, or somebody who's had some sort of debilitating illness, or somebody who's been subjected to discrimination or racism or anything major, anything minor. You can use that formula to overcome and do some work on the preventative side and reach back and help people. And if you can do that, then you can turn the negative to the positive. It'll make a difference. It'll be healing. It could be cathartic, and you'll get some meaning out of it. And it's worked for me, and I know that it can work for other people.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Oh. Fantastic. Yep. Wise words. Very wise words.
Incredible man. Oh my gosh. You've had such an amazing life. I just, yeah.
And done some really good things with it, and we're very much in awe of you. Thank you very much for agreeing to be on our podcast and reaching out. And, I think we've taken up enough of your time now, so probably wrap
up. All right, well, thank you. Thanks for having me on. And, again, if you know people that have other platforms, whether a podcast or some other platform, if you can connect me with them or suggest they have me on, I really would appreciate that. I have message, have mission, well traveled.
Yeah,
definitely.
Okay.
If you're ever in Melbourne, hit us up. We'll meet up. Yeah,
we're around.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, cool. All right.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
Right. Okay. Bye.
Bye. There you go, loyal listeners. What an incredible story of the failings of a justice system put in place to protect vulnerable people like Jeff.
We are so very honored to have Jeff on our show and would like to direct you to Jeff's foundation's webpage, which is www.deskovicfoundation, so that's DESKOVIC foundation.org. We'd also like to direct you to where you can find out more about the Beyond the Bars Recharge Reentry Game. So check out their website at www.rechargethegame.com.
We had so much fun listening to Jeff's story and researching this topic. If you have a topic or a guest you would like to suggest, you can hit us up at Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, Instagram, Pinterest. Where are we? It's just been
we're
everywhere.
In all the places.
Yeah, we're in all the good places. Yes. If you can't find us, do you have your eyes open?
Are you lost?
Are you lost? Do you need help? Look, if you're lost, you can shoot us an email at FridayNightWineFight@gmail.com.
Don't forget to visit our blog, FridayNightWineFight.blogspot.com, for accompanying content to tonight's episode. Oh, thanks so much for listening. Bye.
Bye.